This Week in Retronauts, I talk myself down from farting into the microphone to make a stupid joke. Hello, welcome to Retronauts, hosted by me, Stuart Gipp. So you know it's going to be a blind-driven episode, because here I am. And just to get right into it, I'm going to talk about who I'm joined by on this fine, I was going to say afternoon. I'm not sure what it is where you guys are, but it's the afternoon here, and it's been raining, and it's been awful. So going in alphabetical order, I'm here with John, once again. John Lindemann, hello, how are you?
Hello, follow me.
Oh, there you go. See, you're doing a bit of game speak. We're straight in. That's a little reference to Oddworld there for those who aren't quite on the ball. yeah. And I'm also here with first time on Retronauts, RJ Lake. Is it okay to call you RJ Lake?
Yeah, that is my name. Hello.
Oh, it's your name. Hello. Thank God. Follow me. I did it again. Let's talk about briefly how you guys are, what you guys do. Just so you know who you are. I mean, we know who you are, John, I believe. You're a Digital Foundry man.
Yes, that's right.
That's your official job title.
I am officially known as Digital Foundry Man. I make videos about them technologies and the video games. But I especially love doing retro content. That's what the DF Retro series is all about.
Gotta get me in on that DF Retro. And RJ, what can people find you doing?
Most of the time I am spending very late nights working on a game called Unbeatable. That's I one of the co-founders of D-Cell Games. And occasionally I like do other things. I make a lot of music on the for different things, and
yeah, you've done soundtracks for some indie games and such, is that right? Yeah,
correct. We actually just released one start of the month, Purgatory Dungeoneer. Yeah,
that's awesome. Pretty proud. I love it. And we know each other from arguing the toss about Sonic, like,
oh yeah,
20 years ago.
I've been doing this for like
rest assured, friends. I was there on Sonic forums, being like inordinately mad about Sonic.
Delightful.
For like 10 years.
I love it.
I walked away. I let it go. It's over. Now I get inordinately mad about Sonic on Twitter with strangers. But speaking of inordinately mad, the subject of today's episode of Retronauts, in my opinion, long overdue, is Oddworld. And as you may well know, Oddworld is a big, old, fascinating ball of games industry nonsense that happens to produce some, in my opinion, tremendous video games. Now, I'm not as knowledgeable about how Oddworld sort of got its start and where it began, so I'm going to turn it over to you guys, because I assume that you actually are. I've planned this very well.
Incredible. I mean, where do you even start with this? Because I think, like, Lorne Lanning is a really fascinating guy. He comes out of VFX, like doing VFX industry stuff with Rhythm and Hues, which is they're the VFX company that died because Ang Lee made them make changes to the Life of Pi Tiger very late in production. There's like a whole thing about that recently. But storiedly and famously, they're the studio that did the Babe CGI for those two movies.
Yep.
And he worked on, I believe, the first one before leaving to do Oddworld.
That's weird, because I would have thought, because the second one is so weird and dark, it makes me wonder if there was any influence there. But I don't know if you've seen Babe, Pig in the City. I exaggerate not. It is a terrifying film.
It's wild. No, I mean, it's George Miller.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like, that explains everything.
I mean, George Miller makes some weird family movies between the other stuff he does. Like, he did the Happy Feet movies, which...
Oh, yeah. I didn't know they were him.
Yeah.
Weird.
And those are bonkers.
Yeah, those are like... They turn out to be about like aliens or something. Am I wrong in that one? I haven't seen any of them because they look shite.
They're more interesting than you think.
Like little baby penguin dancing to Outcast. Don't really care. Like,
so just... they're not like about aliens, but what ends up happening is like there's this whole wild thing. It's like all about conservationism is like genuinely the thing. Anyway, we are talking about Happy Feet, not Otto.
Yeah.
No, this is what the listeners want. This is what they expect. I don't know if you've heard one of my episodes before. This always happens, and I welcome it. So it's all good.
I mean, it kind of makes sense, right? Because the whole history of Oddworld is founded off of the back of sort of that early 90s Hollywood, you know?
Yeah,
right? Much. So it is, obviously, you mentioned Lord Lanning, but there's also a second person involved, which is Sherry McKenna, who I believe he met at Rhythm and Hues. And
she was like very much the like mentor figure for him,
and still like a chairman or CEO, I guess, of Oddworld Inhabitants even now.
Yeah,
all these years later.
I think it's wild that they're still a thing. Like the fact that they've managed to hold out for this long is absolutely wild to me, considering everything that happened. But that's getting well ahead. So, do you know how Abe's Odyssey, the first game, Oddworld Abe's Odyssey, released in, I want to say, 1997?
Yeah, 97.
Yeah. 97.
Now, this is a thing that sort of... I'm going to ask sort of broadly, how did you guys first encounter this game? Like, what was your experience with this game when it first released?
Well, go ahead.
You can go first.
All right, I go. So I first played it, actually, not on PlayStation, but the PC conversion. The reason I got into it, and I think we'll discuss more of this, is because I was a big fan of games such as Flashback in Another World, which obviously served as an inspiration for this. I remember just reading like an issue of PC Gamer and seeing this game featured in there and being absolutely floored by the visuals, just the visual design. It was extremely atmospheric and beautiful, even in still shots.
Yeah. It holds up super well.
It really, really does. Yeah. Absolutely. And so I actually picked up the rather large boxed version of the game. And as I would later learn, I think the PC version was actually a port. So it was not the original release. PlayStation was the lead platform. But that's where I played it. I loved the game, and I felt that it absolutely lived up to that style of gameplay that I expected from it. And also Eric Chahi's follow-up, which was Heart of Darkness. Around similar times, I guess. And so I was happy to see that the flip screen puzzle action game was still alive. But what about you, RJ?
So for me, my history with this game specifically is a lot more recent than that.
Oh, okay.
The Oddworld franchise as a whole, like, I've always been fascinated by as a kid. But I had a Sega Genesis growing up. I never had a PlayStation. Like, my first console that what had 3D graphic capabilities was a Dreamcast. Oh. So like I am in the weird ballpark of like, I skipped a lot of those things.
I want to say that I'm still winning. Cause I went from Master System to PS2. I'm still,
that's pretty bonkers. Yeah.
Wow.
That's like a end of 2001 level jump. So my first experience with the franchise actually playing it was Munch's Odyssey at a friend's house. And that game is wild as your first introduction to what Oddworld is. I always remember being like extremely fascinated by the aesthetic of these things, the advertising of these things, like the Munch's Odyssey box art, which is like a Mountain Dew ad.
With him holding the can. Can I chip in on something you said? Actually,
yeah, absolutely.
That is really interesting. That is really interesting because to me. And I know we're going to talk about it in, hopefully, a second episode or something when we get into Munch's Odyssey and etc. But the idea that was the first Oddworld game you played is very interesting to me because, for me, whenever I play that game, all I can think about is this is a bad version of what's come before. This is like an ugly, like abortive version of that, but in 3D. So to see that first, without that sort of, not prejudice, but that prior sort of experience, wouldn't that feels like it would elevate the game quite a lot. And I never really considered that it would ever be played as the first game in the series.
Yeah. So for me, it's... I think the thing I'd say is, while I don't think Munch's Odyssey is very good... Like, I went back and I tried playing it recently in advance of this episode, and I did not enjoy my time with that, suffice to say. But the I think the aesthetic, like, all is there. All the stuff that is inside these games that makes them really interesting to think about for me, yeah, is still in Munch's Odyssey, pretty much wholeheartedly. And like, I mean, that's why, that's what drew me in with that. And it's definitely a game that, regardless of like your feelings on it, on how good it is in executing it, it's like the Sonic Adventure thing. It's like, yeah, this is a game that it's failing on a lot of fronts to do, like to do the things it's trying to accomplish, but it's trying a lot of things, to begin with. And it's trying to translate something that frankly, is a pretty much impossible task to translate into a 3D platformer. Yeah. And it's doing a lot to try to do that. So,
I actually think that's an interesting point, because this ties into the origins of the original games. Because that was their first attempt at doing a 3D game, and it was obviously very difficult for them, and I'm sure being a launch title for a new console also added additional pressure, right? But I think in this case, this kind of ties back into those original games, because it was a, both in terms of a decision made about the game itself and where the industry was at the time. So obviously they decided to make the first two PlayStation / PC games 2D side-scrolling, well, not scrolling, but 2D games. And part of this is down to the fact that the 3D at the time just was not capable of displaying the sort of intricate visuals that Lorne had imagined for this world.
Yeah.
And this coincides with sort of their background. As we mentioned, you know, they were in the CGI, the visual effects industry, right? Working with Rhythm and Hues.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just CG that was big in Hollywood. That's where it really started to take off, but by the early 90s, it was starting to get a take up in the video game industry as well. Obviously, very famously, Rare and Donkey Kong Country made a huge splash with its SGI workstation rendered sprites, essentially, of Donkey Kong, Diddy Kong, and all those characters. And SGI is exactly sort of the foundation of a lot of this stuff, and that's what was used to make Abe's Odyssey, right? So they essentially built off the knowledge that they gained from this 3D industry and tried to leverage that into the world of video games, which is something that I think was actually pretty common back then. You know, like there was all these companies that were like, yeah, we're hiring up all this Hollywood talent to help make our games. And that didn't always pay off, I would argue.
The first example I remember of that would be the Aladdin and such, where they made a big point of getting the animators in for the movie to do the sprites.
Yeah, this crossover with Hollywood, that was such an early 90s, mid-90s thing to do.
Yeah, some Planet Hollywood-esque games. Yeah.
Big time, big time.
Toonstruck.
Oh, God, yeah. Christopher Lloyd, right?
Yeah, that's Christopher Lloyd. Like, there's a lot of games like that.
What a game.
Where they
and got, Tim like, Curry in there as well.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Toonstruck episode. Let's make it happen.
I love that game.
Yeah.
So I guess my point here is that Oddworld kind of comes from two places, essentially. It comes from the Hollywood industry with the 3D rendering stuff, but it also is born out of Lorne's love and appreciation for video games, and specifically, as I mentioned earlier, Flashback, Another World, Prince of Persia. This is the foundation of what Oddworld, Abe's Odyssey, became. Mm-hmm. Essentially, it's a game where you move from screen to screen, and they use this screen-by-screen nature in a very cinematic way, right? Every frame of the world is very carefully designed to communicate a specific atmosphere and idea. And, you know, they pulled it off magnificently. I mean, you guys have played these games, right?
Like, oh, hell yeah. To death.
Yes.
Like, absolutely dripping in atmosphere.
I first came to this game through a friend who had a PlayStation 1, and it got in my head so much that I still have a closet full of levels that I've drawn in Biro on a piece of paper. Just divided them into screens and been like, right, this is the
heck yeah.
This is the slig like bedroom annex house mansion. This is Sligland or whatever. And just designed all these awful Oddworld levels. And I have like 50 sheets of this, and one of these days I'm gonna post them on Twitter or something and just ruin my life.
So but that actually really worked well for this game, I think, and that's they used Alias Wavefront to design this. And the Alias software kind of goes back away. I think it was prior to that, before all the merger stuff, there was like Alias Power Animator, which is what Donkey Kong Country was made with. And they didn't necessarily use polygons. They did the 3D shapes using NURBS. Do you guys remember NURBS?
NURBS.
neurons. N-U-R-B-S.
Oh, I thought you meant like the sweet.
Is this how you get the term? Oh no, it's neurnies, not nerves.
No. It's basically like you get it's for achieving infinite smoothness on curves and rounded edges using like mathematical formulas, and it's often used in rendering rather than like triangles, I guess. And they were able to get these super high detailed, high quality sort of characters and environments that they would then pre-render out, and they created every scene and every character this way. The thing is everybody was doing CG work at the time in the games industry. It was super common, but I think Oddworld is one of the few that not only got it especially right, but it's also one of the only ones that actually still holds up.
Yeah.
I remember them winning like awards with like the opening cutscene from Exodus.
Yeah. Oh, man.
And that was used in a German music video as well, which I wish I could remember the song.
They also tried to take the excess cutscenes and turn it into a short film that they actually submitted to the Oscars with. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that came of that, but like they like cut it together. If you look up Oddworld Abe's Exodus the movie.
I'm actually looking for that. Yeah,
yeah. It's cut together by Lauren Lanning. Like,
all right. Tell me though, is it better or worse than Shenmue the movie?
depends on your definition of better.
Okay.
Well, video game movies have a new standard now, and it's called Sonic the Hedgehog 2, and everything has to be fit to lick its damn boots. Okay.
It sounds like a joke, but that's actually probably true.
I think it's amazing that Abe caught on as well as he did, considering that he's a hideously ugly, withered, disgusting freak with sewed-up lips.
So, I have a theory about this, and this ties into the game design itself. I think a lot of the success of Oddworld stems from GameSpeak, which was essentially their communication system that they built into the game.
It's so cool.
The idea here is that you control this character, right? You platform, jump, climb, all that stuff that you normally do in a video game. Except for in Oddworld, you can talk to other characters in the game. And by using a combination of buttons in the controller, you essentially can communicate. So you can say hello, you can say follow me, you can fart, which I know
Steve loves. The only things that I do in my life. Yeah, and whistle at people and then get arrested.
But does that seem sort of like feasible to you guys? Like, there's an appeal, right? This was the era of the Tamagotchi, you know, Seaman became popular in Dreamcast.
I mean, it still hasn't been imitated by anyone that I can think of. I mean, there's a few like Squad Command games, but that's not really the same thing.
No, you know? it's appealing, the idea of communicating with computerized, you know, creatures in this weird world, and I think that just grabbed people's attention.
I think, the fact that it's got this completely unique world as well, and it does look incredible. I mean, this game reviewed well in an era when 2D games were just completely non grata. Like, you do not want to be 2D. Like, stuff like Mega Man X4 was getting like slammed as just, this is kiddie garbage from the last generation. We don't want this. We want 3D. But Abe avoided that by being state of the art, I think, as well, obviously, it's a state of the art, completely unique, like, visually outstanding game laced with humor, which appeals, obviously. GameSpeak, which is, there you go, that's the cherry on top, completely unique communication system. You're not going to see that in any other game. It's great.
That plus, I think it came out at the exact right time. Like, you look at the late 90s, 97 PlayStation releases. It's like Final Fantasy VII, I think, starts that year. Like, that's when the year kind of kicks off with that game. And then there's, like, Crash Bandicoot 2 and Abe's Odyssey is, like, the end of that year. It's like,
hell
those
two. What a twofer.
So, like, it kind of had a pretty open slate, right? Like, as far as, like, I think it was a pretty big release because it had a lot of money behind it, because it needed to get made. So they pushed it pretty hard, and I think that just like a combination of all those factors, it's the GameSpeak stuff, it's the fact that the game's pretty difficult, but like in a way that I think, especially at the time, like there's a lot of work on death animations to make this game kind of fun to die in, and I think that all those things kind of coupled together make the game very charming.
Speaking on the difficulty, if I can chime in with that, I think this game is difficult, as you say, but the checkpoint system, which a lot of people criticize, I think is mostly okay. Like, considering when it came out, you can save whenever you see the little yellow ape head, you can save there. That's where you're going to come back if you die. The issue is if you want to rescue all the MacGuffins, if you want to find all the secrets, in the first two levels specifically, that's so difficult to do. Because
it's bonkers.
Yeah.
You can't get the, four, five, six secrets in the first, like, eight screens in that game. You have to do all of them without a save. You can't lose a MacGuffin and you can't save. Because if you do, then you lose all of it. It's the most ludicrous challenge to do. And that's why it's not what you're supposed to do, really. You're supposed to rescue enough MacGuffins. You have to rescue all of them. If you do, you get a nice little message, I believe. That's about it. But whenever I play this game now, I really want to save everyone.
I've got to
go down that first pit behind the barrel. I've got to rescue those MacGuffins. And that quite hard.
That first secret room, first secret room is impossible. It's not literally impossible, but you go down there and it is, there's these, the giant, what do you call them? Like the saw blade things.
Yeah, the meat saw things.
Just immediately from, it's the first thing you see if you do that. And it's ridiculous.
I mean, it's all stuff for when you've beaten the game already, because you need that skill. You need skill that you've already learned. But you got to go down there, you got to go down the one and a couple of screens later, you've got to go throw grenades from that secret into the mines to get to the final secret in there as well, which are all nails difficult. You've got to know that you can destroy those chant suppressor machines using grenades.
Oh, yeah.
And you've got to do all of this in one run. And my incredibly uninteresting anecdote about this is I found that barrel secret immediately with no prompt, because for some reason my brain just went, that's definitely a thing. There's no way there's nothing behind that barrel. I think I have some kind of sixth sense, but only for stupid hidden shit in games. Because I'm the same in Mario. I'm just like, that's a fake wall. There's an invisible block there.
You're like,
I can just see him, mate.
QA person.
Yeah, I'm the worst. Yeah.
So, I feel like we should first step back a little bit here and maybe explain exactly what kind of game this really is.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For
the mechanics are interesting, and it's not actually very common these days either. So,
but it is a lot, like, I'm sorry for interrupting you, John. My personal comparison would be directly Prince of Persia. That's what this game feels like to me, to move around. It's all, you know, and if you want to say a 3D one, like the original Tomb Raider, it all feels very regimented. Like, you can walk one square. You can walk one square, you can jump, you can hang. You can never go outside of the specific, like, grid that's designed for Abe to move around in.
I like it.
And it's great, because it means you can be perfectly precise.
A chip challenge platformer.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it is. It's a grid-based 2D platform game, right? You move from screen to screen. It doesn't scroll. It's flip screen. Which I believe Lauren actually noted they could have done scrolling, but they specifically opted not to.
Well, yes, flip screen is, I love flip screen because it means you remember every screen.
Exactly. Every screen is a distinctive piece of art. It's not like a tiled background that scrolls.
You know what else it reminds me of for the Retronauts bingo card holders? Spectrum Games. With this, with screen by screen, nails hard, you can only move certain regimented ways. That's it. It's a Spectrum game.
You're not that far off, actually. It is kind of like a UK inspired feeling, or European inspired design, right?
Like, if I didn't know it was from the US, I would have assumed it was European.
I mean, a lot of the game was developed, I think, in the UK. It was definitely because Oddworld Inhabitants. So it's all US based in terms of like the management. Lauren Lanning, obviously, like, is New England, and then like it's all LA people, but. They like GT Interactive, I think, was a UK-based company, UK-based publisher, and they like absorbed a ton of different development talent from around that area, who The way that Lauren Lanning tells it in like some interviews is basically just like they kind of reluctantly had to work on the game and they didn't want to do it for him.
No, I think GT Interactive at the time was not a European company.
Was not, okay.
It was an American publisher, but they were eventually sort of picked up by Infogrames.
Oh, that's what it is. Okay, yeah,
so
there you go.
I think that was like in the late 90s.
Infogrames. I was just saying Infogrames. Anyway, so go on.
So I think at the time, GT Interactive was still based in the U.S. Obviously, though, they were publishing a lot of great stuff at the time, I think. But including the retail version of Doom 2, interestingly enough. But yeah, so Oddworld then, 2D platform game, like I said there, screen by screen. But you have the game speak, which is what allows you to communicate with other Mudokons. And the Mudokons are essentially this strange, I don't know, what would you call them? Like these creatures that are basically enslaved by this.
But they're emaciated human fish, basically. That's how I describe them. And they have big fantastic fish eyes, but they have, I can't think of a tasteful way to describe
it. That's great. Emaciated humanoid fish people.
Right.
I like kind of the vibe I get from them.
Yeah, there's a little bit of like, I mean, they're pulling in some stereotypes from like some Native American iconography and like African tribes and stuff that there's a lot to be said about all of that, I think. But the, you know, I think that the central tenet of like what their design is it's very fish like. They have the giant eyes, which I think is where the fish stuff comes from. And then they have, like, they all have this, I don't even know how you describe the skin texture. Like, it's not like a human skin. It's like very, like the underside of a snake is what they look like.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Scaly, like scaly skin.
Yeah.
Or more just like describe them as like if normal maps were actually real skin.
I mean, I don't know if it's distasteful, and if it is, I genuinely apologize. They're kind of like almost a slave kind of race.
I mean,
like
they're
kind of born into slavery, kind of.
That's the whole point. That's why they're pulling in like all these.
The corporation rupture. Sorry, John, I don't want to get ahead of you, but the corporation rupture farm is essentially exploiting them. This whole race, like not just for their work, but for the resources that they produce, which we'll get to obviously later. But it's a very compelling intro. But yeah, sorry, John, go on with your...
No, that's exactly right. Yeah. It all kind of ties together. So, like I said, 2D platform game, you're rescuing your fellow Mudokons from this industrial meat processing plant where they've been enslaved, and that's pretty much what you're doing. Because it's narrative-driven, you know, you're sort of following the storyline and sort of getting into this sort of mysticism sort of side of things versus, I guess, rampant capitalism. So, you know, obviously you see the real world parallels there, and you can definitely see what Lauren and team were trying to communicate with the story. They're just doing it with extremely bizarre, unique designs, and I think that's one of the reasons why it works. It's this really good mix of just cool puzzle action platforming mixed with this like crazy atmosphere and storytelling.
The thing with the game speak is it can also appeal to, if you're a horrible monster, you can also be a sadist, because comedy slap. You can slapstick murder, like on one, like the fourth or fifth screen of the game, there's a Mudokon cleaning while standing on a trapdoor.
Oh yeah,
and you there's a lever there, which is just literally pull the lever.
It's so mean.
If you pull it, they'll fall to their death. And later you can drop rocks on them, you can electrocute, you can get them eaten by the slugs, which are like these vicious little dog things. Or you can just get them shot. There's a lot of fun ways to murder Mudokons.
But every single time you do it, though, it's like the bada bomb. It's like that has that that really like you fucked up music cue. It's dun, like boom, boom.
That has to be one of the reasons why it was popular. Though,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Like,
I agree.
People love that stuff. Just experimenting and toying around with these little virtual figures,
throwing grenades at them, getting
all
them
the
minced.
All the systems design stuff, which that stuff's really interesting. And I think what's part of that is, like, it's all escort mission stuff. If you're trying to play the game the right way, it's all escort missions. But it feels like it's just frustrating enough.
But when you get, I know I'm jumping ahead, but in Exodus, something it reminds me of, when you get a large group of Madokans following you in sync, I get Lemmings vibes because you're bringing these people home. Yeah. You know, it's almost like a Lemmings where you're running, except you're running around doing things.
It's very Lemmings,
like Sleepwalker on the Amiga a tiny bit, actually. Now that I think about it, where you've got these people in, they're walking, and you've got to stop them, you've got to protect them, you've got to get them out of dodge. You know,
right.
Yeah. I think we'll get to Exodus. Obviously, think my whole thing with that game is I think it overcomplicates the stuff that I think is really good in Odyssey.
I got some opinions about Exodus. We'll get to that one. Yeah. I mean, the way that it does work with this game speak is you just say hello. The Madokan will activate. They'll say hello back. You say follow me. They'll say okay, and they will follow you. You got to bring them to what's called, I think, bird portals. Which is some old mystical Madokan thing that you can then hold the triggers on, or the L1 and R1 on your PlayStation controller to chant, which causes them to open up. And the Madokan, if the path is clear, will run and jump into it, and that will be them rescued. There are no meaningful collectibles in this game except for that. This is not a collecting platformer. There are no rings or crystals or anything like that. It's rocks, pieces of meat, and grenades that you can get limited numbers of, and Madokans that you can rescue. They're essentially big walking jiggies, if you want to call them that.
And what makes the escorting so interesting, though, is that it also it involves dealing with enemies and traps along the way, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that also includes stealth functions. Like, you'll go into an area, you'll see an enemy there, like a slig sleeping, and there's actually a dedicated button for sneaking.
Yes.
Hold that down, and you, yes. Abe, and all the other Madokans then sort of like creep along, complete with the cartoon.
God, it's so funny, sound effects. John. The way that they pose, the stupid floorboard creaking sounds, even though you're not on floorboards, is perfect.
The squeaky knees sound is terrible. I just, it's in every single Oddworld game, and it is one of the worst sound effects.
I love it.
It's so crazy.
You can't put that one back in the bottle, dude.
They tried to soften it up in Soulstorm. Like, there's a little bit of EQ done, but it's still great.
The sound of the sight of a group of Madokans sneaking along behind a slig who has no idea they're there is really funny to me. Like, it's just a ceaselessly amusing visual, and I love it. I love the sneaking. I love everything about Abe's moveset in this game. It might be worth mentioning, he has next to no aggressive moves. You can't kill enemies except with very... You can trick them.
You can throw grenades. You can kill them in the most terrifying way possible. Like, Abe has the ability to psychically dominate any.
Oh, which, yeah.
Why did I forget about that?
This is the main mechanic of the game, arguably.
Yeah, but interestingly enough, the game kind of organically teaches you how to do it.
Right.
Because you could, on the first level, there are plenty of opportunities to possess sligs, but you don't know that you can do it at that point, necessarily. So you just get past them naturally. It's a very interesting learning curve, I think.
Yeah, that is actually... I almost forgot about that. That is one of the coolest mechanics in the game. By possessing the enemies, you take full control of them, right? And then you can go... And that kind of ties to just this... There is this sort of like sadistic nature to this game, whether it's arming traps, taking over other sligs, and then attacking what were their friends, and then blowing themselves up. And you're just doing all this stuff. You're not normally an aggressive character, but he has these abilities to trigger crazy stuff like that to happen. And it's usually very violent.
When you possess a slig, the only way to unpossess them is to explode them.
Exactly.
And every time you do it, Abe laughs.
So he does.
That's, oh man. Yeah. So that's really what it is. It's just about getting from point A to B to get as many Madokans as you can without getting them killed, even though that's sometimes fun.
Yeah. There are 99 in total, I believe, in this game.
Yeah. And then just dodging enemies in different ways, using the traps, using stealth, possession. You have all these tools available to you. That's it. That's how it works.
There isn't a huge amount of use of it in this game, but they do have a sort of ecosystem going on in the background. You've got the areas you go to after Rapture Farms. You get through the stockyards where you find some scrabs, which are these terrifying, statuesque spider-legged. I don't even know what to call them. Scorpion rhino spiders that can run much. They can run as fast as you, basically.
It's the running that get like it. They are really. terrifying.
The first time, the first time you see one, it's in the stockyards and it's completely in silhouette, and it's the music is so perfect and it's genuinely terrifying. You have to jump into the pit with it.
Oh yeah.
To get out, and it's one of the scariest parts of the game. Even after a million times beating it, like, I still get a little bit edgy when I play that. Because they're just horrible creatures.
Actually, some of that stuff reminds me a little bit of the introduction to Another World. You know, where you get chased
very
by
very much so.
Shadowy
beast. Oh, definitely. Very inspired by that, yeah.
What is the name of that thing at the start of... That whole, like, an intro puzzle.
It's called Andrew.
Where you, like, you got to swing on the rope forwards and then backwards and then do the sprint. I think... Lauren Lanning has talked about how Another World in specific is like a very big inspiration point. I think the one big thing you get from that, besides like the multi-screen and all those things in the atmosphere, is the mines, which I think show up a lot in the stockyards starting. It's like the starting point.
Instant death.
Yeah.
The mines, yeah. The stockyard is interesting because it has a screen that is, in my opinion, probably still the hardest screen in the whole game. Where you have to arm a bomb and then lure a slig into the screen with the bomb to blow up the slig. And it's ridiculously luck-based.
Like, the one that's like, it's like kind of an open area? I'm trying to remember.
There's a screen with two slags. There's a raised ledge on the left you need to get to, and you can't get only one slig on that screen.
It's brutal. It's
so difficult.
Brutal. You know how I did it? I on this playthrough, I literally just cheesed it by running up there after multiple tries. Like, you just
do that.
Yeah. It's if you get the timing like exactly perfect, you can do it. But it's it's a brutal set of screens.
And again, if you're going for 100%, the screen that you are on, there is a secret there that leads to a very difficult secret area that you also have to do at the same time. So basically, you've got to do this secret, and then you've got to suffer this largely luck-based follow-up screen. I would say, as much as I love Abe's Odyssey in that respect, it isn't perfect yet. Like, it has some bits that are a little bit dodgy, I think, where maybe they were too good at it, you know?
Yeah,
I don't know. Because after that, the game is quite reasonable, I think.
Yeah.
Once you go to Paramania and Scrabania and such.
The difficulty curve levels out a lot after the Stockyards. This is also why I think the best version of this game is the PlayStation backwards compatible thing that they have on PS4, PS5 now.
Oh, really?
Because it lets you like perfectly like the same as the Nintendo Online service thing.
You can save states and such.
Yeah, you can just constantly flip back, which makes Abe's Odyssey a lot better.
I agree. If you had the quick save like you have in Exodus, it would be a better game.
It's a much better game with that. Honestly, like it's the only thing really missing from Odyssey that Exodus has.
I know it needs Aulia. That's very critical.
Aulia is also that's the one thing that New and Tasty does.
A re-release perfectly. Of I forgot New and Tasty exists.
New and Tasty, we also have to cover.
we'll get to New and Tasty.
Yeah, we'll get to New and Tasty.
In episode 3 of The Dregs. I didn't hate New and Tasty. Actually, I kind of did, but it's mostly because I was too familiar with the first game.
I go up and down on New and Tasty. I think that it's an enormously ugly looking game, I think, compared to how beautiful this one looks. But I think that it's admirable that it tries to do this aesthetic thing of, it looks exactly like the pre-rendered cutscenes of a late 90s era game with FMV cutscenes, and they're just making it like look like that in real time. And that's kind of
I just think that controlling Abe in a 2D game with the analog stick is just weird, and he doesn't move right. He's too quick.
Yeah, they recalibrated it a lot.
Yeah. The main thing that I remember from that game, and this is maybe a little bit unfair, and if I'm misremembering it, let me know, because I'm sure, John, that you were aware of this when it happened. There was some talk that they were going to put real ads in the Rupture Farms.
They did.
LCD display. They actually did that.
They cut them out, at least. I mean, like, I played it very recently.
Yeah.
That's not in there, I don't think.
That's because I remember them talking about that and just being like, what are you doing? Like, how can you miss the point this hard?
Yeah, it's a pretty rough.
I know that having an anti-capitalist game made by a major corporation is probably not you know.
I mean, like, it's been there have been times where you can, like, do that. The movie Josie and the Pussycats, I think, is the best example of this, where there's just, like,
a movie.
That movie's wild.
It rules.
It's really good. Side podcast talking about Josie and the Pussycats right now.
Yeah, someday.
Oh, my God. The McDonald's bathroom. But other than that, I think it's very hard to do that thing of, like, you're trying to satirize capitalism while just reveling in it. I think that was a mistake.
But going back to Abe's Odyssey, the original game, as you move through that game, you're going through this kind of rite of passage for Abe in his unusual, slightly offensive big face, his mentor. The guy with the big mask,
who's putting these
marks on his hand, and when he has them both, or his palm or something, he can become Shrykol, which is some kind of weird demon god thing, for a matter of seconds when he has a certain power. Because it's the only way to progress through the level whose name completely escapes me. There's like a hub stage where you go to both Paramonia and Scrabania.
It's the It has, like, a name. It's a name.
Yeah, it begins with an M, and it's completely escaped me. I don't know. But I think another thing worth mentioning from Paramonia, and I think also Scrabania, is the game introduces Elam, which is, like, his mount that Abe can ride.
Yeah.
Little weird E.T.-looking creature.
Oh, those things, yeah.
Yeah, and when you get on it, you can run really fast, jump much further. But then you get puzzles where you have to get the Elam to certain areas by guiding it around in the same way that you guide around a Mudokon. And I think it really adds to the... I think it just enormously expands and enhances the puzzle solving. I think once you've got past that horrible, impossible Stockyards level in the beginning, as you said, RJ, I think it was you who said it, the difficulty curve does level out and it becomes a much more fair and fun video game. The thing that at the time I loved is when you go to, like, the once you beat Paramonia, for example, you have to then do the Paramonian Temple, which is like a almost like a hub of challenge rooms. There's like 6 or 7 doors, and each one that you go through, you complete. You have to find this song and then ring some bells in the same.
That is the best part of the game, like absolutely bar none for me. These two challenge like air temples are by far the best section.
I think they're great fun, and the fact that they both end with chase sequences, really well composed, really well directed chase sequences.
Yeah.
Skipping forward just a moment, I think where one of the reasons Exodus went wrong is they went overboard on those rooms. Like, almost every level is just a procession of rooms.
They're over complicated too.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Well, before we get to Exodus, I did want to mention the Japanese release of these
games.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
So for both games, so both of these actually did get a release in Japan.
Yeah.
But there was some interesting changes. First of all, the name, obviously. Yeah. They renamed the first game from Abe, Oddworld Abe's Odyssey to Abe Agogo.
Such a great,
which is fantastic. I thought that
Odyssey was Abe 99 because that's the one with 99 Mudokons to save, and Agogo was Exodus. So I got this wrong the whole time.
It's the year. It's the year.
Oh,
it's the year 1999. So yeah, the sequel then Abe's Exodus was called Abe 99.
Yeah,
which fantastic. I think it's completely bizarre. But the other thing though is that they also removed one of the fingers.
Yeah.
So
because
if you look.
Yakuza thing, right?
Yeah, there was some sort of a negative connotation around the four fingers. And
four means death. It's like
I thought it was a Yakuza thing, like they cut the pinky off or something. I don't know.
Something like that. Yeah. There's something to it, but they basically had to remove it as a result, and so all the CGI work, all the sprites, everything had to be modified to remove that one finger. So if you compare the versions, then you actually see that they had to go through and do that, and that must have been a ton of work.
You re-render every single frame.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a nightmare.
It's nuts.
Incidentally, what I did relatively recently is you can still buy those versions on a PS3 if you have a Japanese account on PSN, which I did do because I wanted to see the differences, and they're only about, I don't know, like 390 yen or something. By the way, if you have a PS3 and you have a Japanese account, for God's sake, buy everything before they take it away from you.
Oh, God.
I cannot stress this enough. There are so many absolutely outstanding Japan-only games that you could buy today for next to nothing, and they're all incredible, and you must do it, okay?
I missed doing a lot of this stuff. I missed out on a lot of the Vita, like the PlayStation Mobile stuff. Mm. There's a few games that I managed to nab, but there's like a bunch of stuff that just doesn't exist anymore.
I bought a couple of PlayStation Mobile games, and I now can't have them. I can't play them anymore. The service is just gone.
But it doesn't let you re-download the...
No. Well, I mean, I've hacked my Vita so I can, but no, they're gone. You can't play them anymore.
Oh my God, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, so I couldn't play Super Crate Box on my Vita anymore. It was just gone. It's horrible.
Gunhouse got its first like big release on that. Yeah. Wow.
Playing Abe's Odyssey on the Vita wasn't great because they had to use the back touch to do game speak, so sometimes he would just jump and then get shot.
Yeah. Oh, God. Sounds brutal. I think, honestly, that if there's one big, big, massive thing that I think the New and Tasty and Soulstorm do that I miss dearly going back to these original games. Yeah. The D-pad is mapped to game speak, and that is just a massive improvement.
I mean, that's fine, but it does mean I have to control a 2D game with the thumbstick, which I'm not...
I get what you're saying. You're right.
The stupid thing for me is that, because I played these games on PC as well, for me, GameSpeak is like, hello is one, yeah, follow me is two.
I remember it was the keypad keys.
Like, zero is chant, like three is wait. That's how I remember it. When you hand me a pad, I'm like, what is it again? What is it? L1 and square. It's a little bit arcane, don't you think? Like, L1 and square, L1 and triangle, they're like major things you have to do all the time.
I like the way that the chanting is the double triggers on the
That's cool. That feels good. That's a good feel. Yeah. It's like clasping your hands together to do the chant.
It's a nice little effect.
I think it's fun when you chant on a room with a suppressor and get zapped and fall over.
And then petulant like that. It's great.
Another great Abe animation is when you press square when there's nothing there and he shrugs at you. He shrugs at you. It's a beautiful, really funny, really good video game, basically.
And all the silly voices and stuff. I mean, all the voice stuff is done by Lorne himself.
He does all of it, and it is wild.
It's a huge part of it.
In this game, that's Abe, the Sligs, and the Gluckons, right?
Actually, you know, sound in general, I think, is something really important to this game.
Yes,
before we get to the next one, obviously, Lorne's voiceovers for these characters, it's super weird and interesting. It doesn't sound like any other game out there. That's awesome. But then they also make excellent use of music and just atmospheric sound in a way to sort of really draw you into the world. And I think that is something that's super critical to the overall presentation here, beyond the visuals.
Oh, absolutely.
And everything. These are static images, but somehow it just feels... I don't know, like almost like you're in another world, so to speak.
It's very much so. It's very absorbing. The way that the ecosystem works as well, the way that the enemies work, the way everything adheres to the same rules, it's very absorbing. Like when you're approaching a slog and the music is tense and the slog is standing there barking at you.
Yeah, you're trying to exactly. Learn.
You get too close, it suddenly kicks into this like action percussive like...
The music is such an interesting thing in this game because there's not a lot of it. In fact, you consciously think about Oddworld music, like it in my brain, I'm like, oh, there's no music in Oddworld. It's like the thing I think in my head, which is obviously very much not true. There's a ton of different cues, and they're very iconic cues. If you like, you can like immediately recall, oh yeah, I know what that sounds like. We even just talked about like the da-da-dum when a death happens. But they're played very deliberately. Like there's a lot of silence in this game, which is unusual, especially at the time.
Yeah. I think they really use that to great effect throughout.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a very intentional decision, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exodus leans more into having music, like tunes in the background, because I can now recall the Fico Depot music, the Slig Barracks music. It's very much like memorable. It's like do, 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 like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, should we talk about Exodus then?
I think so. We've said a lot about Odyssey, and we'll probably jump back like happens anyway.
So,
but yeah, Exodus.
I think the first thing to say actually is that when they envisioned Oddworld, they kind of had this like quintology,
the Oddworld,
whatever.
How presumptuous is that?
Quintology. He did it again.
Yeah. So they basically wanted to have five games, and each game would be like a unique theme. And Munch's Odyssey was actually intended to be the second game, for the Oddworld series. But
I think it was even mentioned in the manual for Abe's Odyssey. It was like at the end, this is the first game in the quintology. The next one is Munch. The next one is Squeak. You know, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly. Odyssey, Munch's Exodus.
The brutal ballad of fungus or fungus.
Fungus
clot.
Such a good name.
Sligstorm and the Hand of Odd. How many cancelled Oddworld games?
Oh, there's so much to talk about.
Hand of Odd is, I think, the one that actually was the closest to actually existing.
I really hope that I hope that a beta or alpha drops sometime and gets leaked or something.
So that's fascinating. Continue.
But basically, I think Lorne and team thought the PlayStation was not well suited to making the 3D game they envisioned with Munch.
Yeah.
And the publisher GT Interactive was very hot for a sequel.
Yeah.
And they pretty much commissioned this, I think, which is Oddworld Abe's Exodus, as a follow-up.
Bonus game.
They were doomed by their own reliability in that sense, because here's the thing. Games slip all the time, and Oddworld didn't. It got out on it was just released on time. It had no big schedule problems. They just delivered the thing, and then because they managed to do that, they were the only one that didn't slip on the publisher slate. They had to put the sequel out too. And
which, again, as you said earlier, it took them 9 months.
Nine months is an delivering any game is a miracle.
Yeah,
So we're about to get into this. I don't like Exodus very much.
Right.
I don't think I've ever actually finished the game. Like, I've seen the ending, but I've never actually managed to get through the whole thing.
Yeah, I've got very mixed feelings about this game. They basically are in the vein of, I do like it, but I think it's a huge mistake. Like, they made a lot of errors with this one, personally.
The biggest one is just the hyper complication of GameSpeak. There's way too many weird hanger-ons to the system.
And the addition of emotions to the Madokans amounts to essentially nothing. It's just, you can still get them to follow you, but you've got to individually say,
you have to slap them now?
You slap them when they're on
Drunk Nothing with gas. Happiness. Yes, yeah, the gas, that's right.
All it amounts to is, it's not dynamic. All it amounts to is just, when you encounter this, you have to do this.
It's just an extra.
So you're walking around a group of 9 Madokans, individually holding L2 and circle on each one to say, sorry.
Sorry.
It's just almost tedious.
It's almost like the game was made in 9 months.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is why I while I don't like the game, it's hard for me to be there's the part of me that's I can't fault how this came out. I can't it's still an achievement that they managed to put together this much new art, this much new level design. I think some of the level design is good. I think there's some stuff that I like in there. I like that you can possess the Gluckens in Exodus a lot. I think that's a fun.
Well, they made it. You can possess almost anything. You can possess the Scrabs now and the Paramites. You can even possess your own fart,
mm-hmm.
which is the most absurd, brilliant. Look, when I played this game for the first time, I was 11, right? Possessing your own fart, which you then fly around, and it makes fart noises while it flies around, and then it explodes with a big fart. Come on, that's the funniest thing in the world.
That's something.
The messed up thing is that in Abe's Odyssey and Exodus, the fart, as stupid as it is, it actually has utility beyond doing the whistling puzzles in the first game, which is that if you fart on a Madokan, they will walk one square away. Which sometimes is genuinely useful.
I did not know this until you said that right now, and that it's really fascinating.
You fart them; they hilarious. It's still funny to me. They go woof, like that, and then they walk one score away from you. And sometimes that's incredibly useful.
Yeah, I can imagine. So there's a ton of places.
Can you guys think of any other game in history that has a fart mechanic?
Comic Zone.
Oh,
Comic Zone has a fart mechanic.
Yeah,
feels like we need There needs to be a list of these games.
If you squat, and maybe it's more of a joke than a mechanic, but if right. you squat like a ton of times in a row, sketch just farts, like just rips one right there.
Incredible.
I feel like there has to be another game though. Besides
Boogerman is too easy, right? Boogerman is too easy.
Yeah.
Lost Vikings 2, one of the fat one whose name I forget, Olaf. He farts. That's one of his moves.
Of course he does.
No, that's probably one of the Shrek games. This is now the Retronauts fart episode.
Yeah, yeah, probably the Shrek games use farts as mechanics. The like.
Actually, surprisingly enough, because I've played all of the Shrek games, because I'm a big loser.
I know those games are good, as far as I remember.
Some of them are pretty good. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Shrek episode in the future, folks. This is happening. We're getting to it.
But they're foundational in 3D graphics.
Oh god, yeah, the first Shrek game on the Xbox is absolutely out of its mind. But we'll do that someday.
One of the first games ever using a deferred render.
The first game to ever use a deferred.
Absolutely first. Absolutely insane. Right.
But in many other ways, that Exodus is like Shrek. It is a flawed sequel. I think I do like the game. My major issue with it is the fact that it sacrifices that feeling of the verisimilitude, the atmosphere that you're in there. It sacrifices that for much more gamey stuff. Like, everywhere you go on almost every screen, and every screen it feels like there's a massive sign that just tells you what to do. An arrow saying, go here. This is a thing. Get this. Do this. The whole game feels like a measured tutorial because of the fact that, okay, let's write this up. Okay, the Slig Barracks, okay, Boneworks, and finally, the return to the brewery, right?
There's
all
like
of
the,
those.
All the
there are three floors of the brewery, and all those stages, all they are is a series of bespoke challenge rooms where you're in a hub, you go in a door, you do a little puzzle or whatever, you come out, you do the next door. That's like the whole back half of this game. That's all you do. There's no going, you don't travel. It's not like, oh, I'm going somewhere. You go on a train and you just go there and it's cool, but it's not the same. There's no feeling that you're making huge progress at any point because all you're doing is solving silly little puzzles in silly little video game rooms. It's all very... It takes you out of it, I think. And I love it. It's a fun game. I feel like the fact they put the quick save in may have been a crutch, in a sense.
So, yeah, I can tend to feel that things like the quick save and the signposting that is so common... To me, this feels like a symptom of a game that had to be turned around very quickly after the original, based on feedback they had from that original game.
Yeah.
So I'm sure they did, you know, plenty of testing and all that, and they're like, well, okay, people didn't like XX and X or these things, and we've got to fix that. And so I'm sure they built this new game then with that in mind, that we're going to make this better, we're going to make it more accessible and try to remove the frustrating bits. But they ended up going too far.
I got to stress once again, I do still like this game. I do enjoy playing it. I think there's a lot of stuff about it that is cool. I like the fact that they have a visual cue for which screens have hidden secrets now, with the Soulstorm brew bottles lying around. If you see those bottles, that's, you know, there's a secret in that room. And that's a very clever thing to do, I think. I feel like... the fact that you can possess things like Scrabs and Paramites, it's just half-baked. It's usually just to do something incredibly obvious with them. There's no real crafted puzzles. It's just like, oh, this is a bit where you have to get past some Paramites, so you need this Scrab. That's all there is to it.
Well, there are fleeches here,
you need a Scrab. It's not very thoughtful. It's all very just, like, perfunctory. The Gluckin bits are much better, I think, because you are
they're intentional and they have like actual design to them. There's like the ridiculous bit where you have to like send multiple slings into mines over and over again to clear a path. Like, that stuff's great. But when you
brainwash in Boneworks, I forget the name, Director Flegg or something. There's a whole sequence where you're ordering around a slig to operate ladders for you and then to shoot through a whole kennel full of slugs while you stand there screaming, like,
because you don't have
arms. Kill them! And it's one of the most metal things. Like,
It's great. Okay, the fucking... The Gluckins and the humor in this game is ridiculous.
They made it, I think, a lot more sitcom-y in this game.
There is... So, in the bad ending of this game... oh my god, there's so much stuff to touch on here. There is a bit where, I forgot which Gluckin it is, but like in the bad ending of this game, they're like torturing Abe, right? He's in like an electric chair or like a gurney or whatever it is. And they're like, I think it's the Slig says, like, boss, you're pushing it too far. And he says, in the most insane line read of all time, it's like, what the hey, let's go for the record, pump it up! Exactly like, it's like, ridiculous.
I remember that, yeah.
It's complete lunacy.
The bad ending of Abe's Odyssey used to kind of freak me out. It was kind of upsetting. When Abe is hanging there and the other McGuckins are just like, he didn't do anything, and then he just does like the throat slit gesture and just goes, let him! And it's horrible. It's really upsetting.
these games all universally feel like they have like really like distressing bad endings. There's later on, Soulstorm has probably the darkest one of all. Which, God,
don't spoil it.
I'm not going to spoil it. It's wild.
I'm looking forward to experiencing it.
I think in general we haven't even like talked about the cutscene presentation of any of these games yet, which we have a little bit.
I think because the cutscenes were like revolutionary at the time.
They very much were,
especially in this one.
Yeah.
They decided to do everything in rhyme, which is was a choice. I'll say that's how I feel about that.
They made the whole game speak in verse. That made it worse. Does that work?
Yeah, exactly. It did.
We should do a whole Retronauts in rhyme. I would love that.
No. I think that there's less rhyming in Exodus. I can't remember if it's like all just completely verseless compared to Odyssey, which is just a Dr. Seuss thing. But the like, there's a lot more cutscening in Exodus, which I think weirdly feels, I think contributes to this disjointed feel, where there's so much more polish put into the bits that made the first game feel seamless and atmospheric. But I think that it's kind of papering over this thing you're talking about, where it doesn't feel wholly conceived. It feels like you're putting a bunch of different level design elements into it.
It feels like a bit like, and I hate saying this, it's a very cliche thing to say, but it feels like they're just throwing a lot of shit at the wall and seeing what sticks.
Absolutely.
Because like in the first game, towards the end, you gain the power to shoot this concentric red ring that can blow up mines. It's very empowering. You only get it from a certain place, and you only get it, I think, once or twice. And in the Abe's Exodus, before long, you've got a yellow one that cures sick people. You've got a green one that turns you invisible temporarily.
Oh my god, it's
and
too
it's like
much.
Okay,
it's
I get it. Like, there's a lot of there's a lot of sequences where all you do is turn invisible and have to run past some fleeches and pull levers before you become uninvisible, and it's all very perfunctory and very easy, I think. So that's, although I do like the fleeches, they're kind of scary.
It does feel like it's more just like a chance to extend the gameplay experience where they could, which I can understand the appeal of that, but the original feels more like a directed experience, you know?
I absolutely agree.
Everything feels very carefully considered. Here's like, we did this mechanic, let's just do a few more screens.
It feels like it was thought about for like a long time.
The original is a vision. It's a presented a vision, and then you've just got a game. Like, that's what Abe's Exodus is to me. It's just a game.
They turn
and
it into
it's a good
game.
It's a good game, but it's just a game. It does not. The things they added feel like they were added. I don't know. It's like when you play an FPS expansion, like for Quake, and the new enemy is just, it's a knight, but it's red and it's a bit faster.
That's
not new content. Like, a flying slig is not that interesting. A slig with no pants, while funny, is not that interesting. It's not till, like, Munch, when you got like the mega slugs, the terrifying like massive hench ones. That's a cool addition, I think.
Munch does a bunch of new things, but then Munch was the thing that they wanted to do, and Exodus was just like a hang-on.
Which kind of goes against, you know, the themes of the first game anyway, with capitalism and all that, right? We gotta make this in a year.
I mean, it's only because
bad boy out.
It's only because of Lorne Lanning that we have the term money hat, right? That came from Penny Arcade with him.
That was regarding Munch when it was originally
when Microsoft money hatted it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which is a weird thing to think about. But
that
game, you know.
Yeah. Well, Hand of Odd and Munch's Odyssey were slated for PS2, presumably.
Yeah, that's
at the
right
time. And then I think it was quite a big thing, almost like a, not like the level of Microsoft buying Rare, but it was not far off.
Yeah, Microsoft, going, like,
yeah, let's have those games.
He could not get Munch's Odyssey funded, as far as, like, I know, like, in terms of, if you try, okay, for anyone who hasn't pitched a video game before, it is one of the most insane things to try to do. And I can understand if you're going, even from having, like, the, like, Abe's Odyssey sold millions and millions of copies. It's like the, I think, top 25, like, best-selling PlayStation games.
Yeah, it's platinum as well, wasn't it?
Over 3 million copies.
It sold
for
more
sure
than Resident Evil 3. Like, it's a wildly successful game. And
which
he still, because of how weird Munch is, he could not get that thing, like, a publishing deal. And Microsoft coming along and being like, we'll just do this and it'll be exclusive, I think, was more, it's a combination, I think, of, yeah, the thing you're talking about, the money-hatted, I think is the phrase.
Yeah, that's the Penny Arcade phrase.
Yeah,
the NeoGAF back in the day used to say that a lot.
But it's also just like, I mean, it's kind of a Hail Mary pass. He's getting that, and he's able to actually make the game he wants to make on the Xbox. But yeah, like, I think that's kind of informed by his experience with Exodus, where just this nightmare production, and I do not think, like, I don't think he's satisfied with Exodus. I don't think he looks at this game fondly.
No.
And
well, I think given Soulstorm is kind of a do-over of it, isn't it?
Soulstorm is a full, like,
It's not a remake of Abe's Exodus at all.
No, it's not new and tasty.
It's not.
Right.
But, I mean, Soulstorm, wasn't that actually the original name of the first Oddworld?
It was. It was
like,
called Soul Space Storm, I think.
Yeah, like, that's right.
Yeah. So Oddworld Soulstorm is like almost a mission statement to be like, this is what I'm getting back to, like, trying to do the thing I wanted to do in the first place. As
exactly.
I think
you know, even though when I tried it, I didn't like Soulstorm, and as I understand, it's now being patched up and is much, much better. But
yeah.
I want Lorne Lanning to be able to do what he wants. You know what I mean? I want Oddworld to exist in the world. I want Soulstorm to sell well enough to get the next game in the series.
Me
imagine
too.
A world.
Yeah.
Imagine a world where the Quintology is actually done.
Imagine a world.
I
would
lose it if we get all five games.
That would be crazy.
Be
even if they're all terrible. Like, I just really want it to happen.
I think both possible paths where it's successful are good. It could be that there's a full Quintology, or you could get him getting distracted and making Stranger's Wrath 2. And that's still a good world to live in, I think.
Yeah.
It's weird because these games are clearly influential. I was talking about this to someone the other day. These games are very influential games for a lot of people, I think. But they're also really siloed off. You don't talk about Oddworld unless you're talking about Oddworld.
Yeah.
Like, it's a weird thing.
Well, they're their own thing, aren't they? You can't compare them to much other than older games, like Prince of Persia. There's nothing else like them now.
Which is a shame. There should be.
Even indies don't touch on it that much. I played a game called The Eternal Castle or something remastered, which is not
a
remaster.
Eternal Castle is fantastic.
Yeah, and that reminded me a little bit of Abe's Odyssey, because that was very out of the world kind of
game. I would say that the closest thing we have to it in modern terms is stuff like Limbo or Inside.
Inside, I think, specifically. Like, replaying Abe's Odyssey for this. The big thing that it made me realize is like, Inside isn't like as much an Eric Chahi game as it is an Oddworld game. Like, it really is a streamlined version of this, down to the fact that you're like controlling like little other guys for a lot of the puzzles. There's like a lot of different things where you're kind of like trying to escort people around or there's a lot of different stuff like that in Inside. Inside's great, and I think
I should finish it.
It's good.
Yeah.
So I guess the big thing here, though, is we've talked about these PlayStation games, but what about Oddworld Adventures for the Game Boy?
Oh, God, I forgot that existed.
I did, too.
I've got that as well. I have the
and
cartridge.
Two. They made a sequel.
Yeah. Sequel was all right.
Isn't it supposedly, like, trying to be a port? I do not know much about that game at all.
It's kind of like, I would describe it as a demake. yeah. perhaps, where
That's
it's like
fascinating. You know, I'm looking at it has, this right now.
Yeah,
it has elements of Oddworld, but it doesn't. Yeah. You know,
oh,
you
I
can
need
tell
to
it's not the same game, but it's,
I need
it's
to
neat.
Play this.
Yeah,
it's
still
not screen by screen.
It's not horrible. Yeah.
This is the Donkey Kong land of.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
I think that the first one, the second one, was one of those hybrid Game Boy and Game Boy Color games. I think.
Yeah, the second one was color for sure. Because
the first one was just straight up a Game Boy game.
I am looking at this. This is so weird. It's
really weird, yeah.
Looking at a game like this with just full pixel graphics is extremely strange, I gotta say.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
What's funny about the Game Boy one, though, is that with fewer buttons, they couldn't do as much with GameSpeak. So the only actions you have is, like, you can do the chanting, you can whistle, I think, and then there's the fart.
Yeah, I think you've got to press select to do it as well.
It's so that, they kept the fart.
Yeah, of course they did. Like, the fart is the main thing people want from the game.
They kept the fart. They keep the or like at least a facsimile of the like marquee like screen tutorial thing.
Yep.
They try to do that. Yeah. That is probably one of my favorite elements of that. When I first played Odyssey. That was the thing that felt the most distinctive to me, was that choice of, like, everything is tutorialized to you through these, like, giant marquees that are everywhere in the factory.
Yes.
And it feels, it's like such a good, like, hybrid of, it is a good introduction to, like, what it's like being in this factory where there's messages thrown at you just incessantly over and over again. And it kind of is a little snarky. It, like, tells you there's certain elements of a little bit of the bossiness that the tutorial has towards the player. It feels like a little bit of a fourth wall break.
I mean, the loading screen says sit down and shut up.
Oh my god, yes, you're right.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a little bit of fourth walliness. Like, the second game has Abe kills one of the Madokans, basically, and then...
One of the blind ones,
And then he literally turns to the camera and says, I guess help me rescue the rest of them. Like, it's pretty...
I'm a terrible person, so whenever the blind Madokans walk into a wall, I laugh. The first time you meet one, it's right in front of a bird portal, and you chant, and it's scripted. He runs past the bird portal into the wall.
Then he
gets up, runs back and doubles back and jumps into it, and it's genuinely funny. And I feel bad laughing at it.
It's a Three Stooges joke.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot.
There are bits in Exodus where you can slap Sligs and use that to just make a quick escape because they'll be down for like a half second.
Oh,
and it's genuinely got some. It's genuinely quite useful in times.
And that's something about the series. It's just so unique. Is that weird fusion of slapstick humor like that. With this really unsettling atmosphere, and it's hard to imagine how they pulled it off so well.
I think with Exodus, and another problem I have with Exodus in a way is, as we've discussed, it's sort of a maximalist thing, and it's too big for Abe. In the first game, Abe escaping Rupture Farms, going on a spiritual journey away from Rupture Farms, then coming back, finding out about the boiler, going in and destroying it, I believe he could do that. I don't believe he could systematically go to the barracks, the boneworks, and all these places and take all of them down and get past everything. It's too big. Do you know what I mean?
I think in terms of how the game is presented, I don't think
He's a destructive force that makes you feel more powerful than the enemies, and you're not supposed to be more powerful than the enemies.
Right, it doesn't really do the work of making Abe feel reluctant anymore. It doesn't really do the work of trying to at least make you feel like Abe is coming at this from a low status thing. He just becomes this larger than life figure without any sort of actual, it's more of a, he becomes Bugs Bunny in the second game.
Yeah.
Kind of. It doesn't work as well. All the Gluckans talk like Powered by the Cheat characters. Like, all these things just feel a little bit
off. This is my regular.
Exactly. All of them, it just feels a little bit like the ingredient mix is off, you know?
Can I praise one thing in Exodus that I really like? Is there's a bit where you interact with a monitor and a Slig tells you, like, welcome to Boneworks. If you have any questions, please pull the lever to your right. And you pull it and a big rock falls on you.
That's very funny.
Yeah. That's a great joke. But otherwise, it's a bit too Bart Simpson. You know, it's just kind of like banter and laughs, and it's weird. It's not Abe
Simpson. Oh my! That I think that clicks for me a lot of this. It feels very much like the first game feels like it's trying to be Star Wars, and I think that that's very consciously trying to be like a Star Wars thing. The second game feels like The Simpsons. You're right, and it's
like they want to make an animated series of Abe or something,
or Animaniacs.
Weird buddies.
Yeah.
Well, let's not say things we can't take back.
I know your feelings on Animaniacs.
Yeah. I have a whole podcast dedicated to hating Animaniacs. I mean, if Abe started talking about Gregory Peck, maybe we'd have something.
That's the thing, though. Like, the reason I say Animaniacs, I think that while it doesn't get into like the pop culture thing, it like leans on that a little bit. It's very caricaturistic in Exodus. It gets very... like, the games were always social commentary, but it feels like the quote-unquote capital S, capital C social commentary, like, TV shows of the time, where it's, like, a sitcom that's just like, hey, you heard about this?
Well, you've even got the news, the Magog on the March thing.
Where you
just watch news reports that are, like, parody comedy news reports.
Exactly. Like, it's all contributing into this.
But again, I don't hate it. I think they're two very fun games, and I think we might be coming to the end of the road on this one, maybe, unless there's more to say about them.
I mean, there's not that much more to say to it, because it really is just sort of expanding on that original game, but in not so great ways. But I will say one compliment I do want to lend it is the graphics.
Oh, yeah.
I think the actual CG rendering that they did here is better.
It's stunning.
It's really, really good. Like, some of the CG sequences, like, the thing about CGI, especially like those full movie sequences, is you go back to actually this era of PlayStation games, and most games outside of maybe the most expensive Square or Namco productions, the CGI is really bad.
This looks way better than the FMVs in FF7. Like,
it does. Like, it's so good. It's so good. Like, it's really, really, really just beautiful and just artfully made and well animated. It holds up.
The diversity of the locations is great as well. They're all very different looking, I think. Even you'd think that, like, Boneworks and the barracks and the brewery would look fairly similar, but they genuinely don't. They did a great job with it.
Yeah.
The final area, even across its three or four different challenge room maps, it does change up the color scheme, change the way it looks. You know what? I've just realized what it kind of reminds me of is Oh No More Lemmings. It's exactly the same mechanics with superior graphics and levels that are off the chain hard. Like, there are secrets in this game in Exodus that require perfect completion. And to me, that's like, well, that's why the quick save is there, because they knew this was BS.
if this is Oh No More Lemmings, does that make Munch's Odyssey Lemmings 3D?
I'm afraid it does.
I mean, by definition.
Uh-oh.
It could have been the tribes. It could have been good, but no, it's Lemmings 3D.
There's, I think, the thing that always impresses me the most about this game, like, is the blending between these cutscenes and cutting the gameplay is the most seamless of any PlayStation 1 game that tries that trick. Going from the train to being out and, like, now you're on the platform.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It is perfect. There's no other game that manages to get that right.
The thing where you go in, like, a door or a well, and the game, like, does this ridiculous 3D pan over to the next area is very impressive.
That's so good, yeah.
They do it a little bit in Odyssey, but it's so much better in Exodus, and the trick is perfect.
They do it a lot more here, and it really gives the environment this sort of, like, three-dimensionality that it kind of technically doesn't have.
Mm.
But also, like, we didn't mention this, but a lot of the backgrounds have stuff happening on different layers.
Yeah.
Which also contributes a lot to the level design and sort of the feeling of being in a larger place.
Yeah.
Like, you'll have, like, scaffolding and stuff way in the distance, and there's actually active enemies back there patrolling and, you know.
Yeah.
Just that sort of,
and
like,
and they can, you didn't mention it, but they can shoot you in the foreground,
exactly.
So you've got to hide behind
them.
Like, isn't there a part with, like, there's, like, in, like, the army barracks, like, area where there's, like, cutouts of Mudokons that are riddled with bullet holes.
So good.
You hide behind those, and they're shooting at you from the background.
Oh, my God. Yeah,
there's a bit in the barracks where you have to roll through and jump through just, like, cover to cover, like gears or something.
Yes, exactly.
And it's literally, again, it's quick save material because it is insanely difficult. Like, you will die if you don't time it perfectly. Like, there's bits where you've got to jump and hang because the cover is on the bit where you're hanging. It's ludicrous, but it's so well
designed. There's a lot of that in these games, though, where you have to very quickly do an action. Run, roll, jump, do something while something else tries to kill you. And there's, like, very little leeway.
Yeah,
there's nothing
as
difficult as that one screen in Odyssey and Exodus.
That's true. I think that, in general, the, like, Odyssey's level design is better when it's doing these kind of challenge rooms.
I agree, yeah.
Yeah, like, all the Scrabania and Paramoya stuff is, like, all of those feel very well-designed and intentional, and the stuff in Exodus does feel a little bit thrown together comparatively. Like, even the stuff that's, like, fun to do, it just feels like, oh, here's, like, some game elements on the screen, whereas there's these very clear, okay, I have to go here, and I have to think about the space in Paramoya levels, like those, like, areas
because of the fact that the Scrabs and the Paramites have such different behavior. Like, Paramites aren't necessarily aggressive. They're only aggressive if they're either cornered or there's more than one of them, and you got to use that to your effect, because it means that when you're in Paramonia, you have that sense of, like, this could turn at any second. This could turn, they could come down on their little webs and come at you. Or you could just be okay with it. You could be okay. You could be in an area where you're just whistling and you're solving a puzzle. You're moving Elam around. It's a little bit chill. But then when you go to Scrabania, every screen you're just like, God, I hope there's no Scraps. They're so terrifying. And you know they're out there, and it just makes it all the more. Like, you're in their home, man. You're in their turf.
They're
baby.
Huge. And then they buck like rhinos. They do that insane thing where when they fight each other, they, like,
They go into,
like,
a death tornado.
They, like,
yeah.
Beyblade each other.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And then they make that perfunctory in Exodus by making it into a power-up thing you can use, where you roar and then you do a big spin, and it's like Crash Bandicoot or something. Ludicrous. At least with the Paramites, you get to actually communicate with the other Paramites using clicks and your horrible mandibles. Oh, man, I do like Abe's Exodus. I just got a lot of bad things to say about it. That's all.
I think this is the thing. Like, if you're coming out of, like, talking about both games, especially with, like, these, like, almost, you're going on 30 years of hindsight. It's like full to 25 years now. 25 years for Abe's Odyssey now. So, yeah, like, all of that hindsight behind, like, it's hard not to see Exodus as a much lesser thing, I think, in that context. But especially with the context of the time when it was just fresh, you look at this game in 1998, like a year after the first game comes out, it probably doesn't feel nearly as down as a thing. It's just disappointing because there's only two of these.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
you'd think
there shouldn't have been either. That's the thing.
Yeah. Well, I think that kind of effectively brings us to something of a close. Like, would you agree?
Yeah, I think so.
With Abe's Odyssey and Abe's Exodus, the two major PlayStation games, as we all know, this is not the end of the Oddworld story. We've talked a little bit about what's coming. I think we can do it in one more episode, but there's a lot to cover. You know, so we'll see how it goes. But, you know, keep an eye on us, and there's a chance there will almost certainly be a part two in the future about Oddworld, covering the buyout, the Xbox games, and maybe the state that it's in now. Yeah.
Exactly.
But before we head off, let's cover this in a bit more detail. John, where can our fine and wonderful and generous listeners find you on the internet?
You can find me at Dark1X on Twitter, or find my work over on Eurogamer.com/Digital Foundry and YouTube.com/Digital Foundry.
And RJ, where can we find you online?
I'm on Twitter. I'm at Spellbang. You can check out all my stuff on Bandcamp. Spell my name with a bang. Bandcamp.com. Check out Unbeatable. Unbeatablegame.com. White Label is free to download on Steam. So yeah, go check out what I'm working on.
Extremely cool action rhythm game that was kickstarted, I want to say, a year and a half ago, 2 years maybe?
Just about, yeah. July 21, so.
Yeah. Very cool game. Got a lot of style, and I recommend it. And I backed it, so there's my seal of quality. You can put that on the box.
Thank you. I will.
I'm going to just fucking like, good, mate.
Put it in very small font with a...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you look out for that, and as for me, you know me, you can find me at Stupacabra, and if you want to support Retronauts on our Patreon, you can do that, and for a mere $5, which again, a very small amount of money, we'll all agree, especially with the current exchange rate, it's not very much money at all, and for that, you can get exclusive Retronauts episodes every Monday, that you can't hear anywhere else. And you can get early access to the other episodes as well. Not only that, you can also get Diamond Fight's very, very good columns, which he does this week in retro. You get them in both written form and in audio form. I must say they are excellent. I have petitioned Jeremy Parrish to let me do Stuart Gyps this week in Stuart Gyps Head, but he has refused. That's not true. He has refused nothing. I made that whole thing up for a joke. But there's a lot of stuff on that Patreon, and you know, again, $5, just, you know, don't buy a large Coke and a sandwich one day, go hungry, and then you can have a month of excellent retro content. There are also higher tiers where you can force us to talk about something awful if you want to, by supporting that for a few months and then going, Stu, I want to see an episode about, I don't know, Jungle Book games or something, and I'll be like, oh god. But I'll have to do it because it's the law.
I've played those Jungle Book games, man. I mean, you know,
they're not horrible. They're not horrible. No,
I like the Mega Drive one at the time.
Yeah, it's pretty good. You can buy it right now in the Disney Aladdin and the Lion King collection. They chucked it in there as DLC. The absolute legends. I love Digital Eclipse, man. Maybe one day they'll touch Oddworld. Who knows? But that was the episode. That was Oddworld. Thanks very much for listening. Hope this all comes together. And a huge apology to the editor, who's going to have to make sort this mess out. Thanks very much.
Oh, yeah.
And take care, and we'll see you later.